In this episode, we dive into macro history, what it is, and how it's the history of non-reproducible systems, but we really dove into so much more. We cover micro history versus macro history, cause and effect, how micro history can give us temporal causation, why better record keeping improves innovation, how we've mainly reasoned by analogy so far, and why our history is subjective, how social media has provided us with decades of digitized documentation about our recent history on an unprecedented scale, why big data should really be called big history, why citizens' assemblies are a better way to govern, how having a shared understanding of what is true impacts decision-making, the best methods for decision-making we've seen so far, how tracking the performance of our government should be like tracking the performance of your startup, what are the key performance indicators of a country, what are the best ways to change people's behavior, what triggers changes in behavior, and finally, what a holistic system of high-quality, diverse, democratic decision-making could look like and why it's better than what we have today. We're just starting out and could really use your support. So if you like this episode, please gently push that like button into its snug place. Share this episode, comment, let us know your thoughts, and sign up for our newsletter. I promise we'll make it worth it for you. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Network State Podcast. How are we doing today, Raph?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing pretty good, pretty good. Pretty exciting topic today. We are going to be covering macro history. Macro history is the history of non-reproducible systems. Last episode, we covered micro history. So if you haven't listened to that one, I'd go ahead and recommend listening to that one first, because this is the other end of the spectrum. So to give a quick brief here, macro history is the history of a non-reproducible system, one which has too many variables too easily be reset and replayed from the beginning. It is history that is not directly amenable to controlled experiment. At small scale, that's the unpredictable flow of a turbulent fluid. At very large scale, it's the history of humanity. So let's break this down. What does this mean? And why is that different from micro history?
Oh man, I feel like this is a reading comprehension quiz.
Yeah, it really is. Each of these like first paragraphs that he gives us are always like that.
Yes. All right. Open your book to page 26. Let's do the exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, again, really plays well in light of what we now know from microhistories. If we hadn't gone so deep into microhistory, I don't think I would have been able to understand what I would have misunderstood basically the term macro history.
Yeah.
But if micro history are, again, the really focus on reproducible, as in like these things that we can control for and keep putting forward as, he likens it to a, you know, physics experiment. I think for society, it's basically all the stuff that isn't subject to too much like human interference, I guess. And then there's this whole other side of the spectrum where it's like, well, no, actually, these are things we can't measure at all because they're coming out of there. I guess in economics, we would have said like externalities, but apparently what I guess he wants to say is that, well, these guys are externalities because we'll never model them. We can just track them. And then that is the model. You know, we're not experimenting with these factors. So, okay, let's see it. It's funny because the first time I read it, I thought, okay, this is about like long cycles, you know, like long development cycles, history cycles, financial cycles, whatever. But I guess if he says there's a thing at small scale where we're just like, that's where just things are happening that we wouldn't be able to hold on to, the fluidity aspect, then that's not a long cycle, obviously. So I don't know. I'm curious to get into it.
Yeah, I think it's also, you know, and he kind of brings this up. It's like, you know, if micro history and macro history were on a continuum, they'd be on opposite sides. And to me, macro history is more the history that we know as history. So like where it's much more complicated, there isn't a way to just, you know, put in an input and get a predicted result.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Right, it's just a lot more messy and influenced by all these other kinds of things. But yeah, so let's dive into...
it's a cool reframe. I'm open to it. Open to it.
Yeah. Okay, so here we go. We think of macro history as being on a continuum with micro history. Why? We'll make a few points and then tie them all together. First, science progresses by taking phenomena formerly thought of as non-reproducible and hence unpredictable systems, isolating the key variables and turning them into reproducible and hence predictable systems. For example, Koch's postulates include the idea of transmission pathogenesis, which turned the vague concept of infection via miasma, in quotes, into a reproducible phenomenon. Expose a mouse to a specific microorganism in a laboratory setting and an infection arises, but not otherwise. So that's just kind of like, you know, causation, right? Any more diving into this piece, or should we move on to the second?
Well, firstly, what does that mean by first? Why are we starting with this? And also, it's so difficult because it's like, well, I'm not an expert on this, so he could just say anything, you know?
And yeah, I'll just. He's definitely he's relying very heavily on all these different examples, but he does link out to them. So, you know, if you do want to dive deeper, go onto the website, check out Koch's postulates, and you can see, you know, what he's talking about there. But yes, he does like to, you know, use very obscure, or what would seem obscure, concepts to illustrate his points. But I think it's because they're like actually good examples. So you probably had to do a lot of looking to find, you know.
No, that's true. It's smart. It's true. It's just, I'm wondering, like, who is he speaking to? You know, like, who knows? Who's like, oh yeah, that example. Oh yeah, I didn't think you're gonna bring that one in. You know, it's like examples are meant to
illustrate the point in a better way, in a less complicated way. Yeah.
Yeah, and he gets to it, but I feel like it's so much detached from what the original point is supposed to be. It's like, okay, all right, I'll go along with it. But yeah, no, but let's hit it, because I mean, yeah, step one, okay, fine, non-reproducible to reproducible, we're figuring it out, and there's sort of frameworks or guideposts that we can put in which allow us to say, okay, this is the space we're looking at, and this allows us to focus in a bit better. So that part I get.
Yeah, I think, you know, for this first point of, you know, expose a mouse to a specific microorganism in a laboratory setting and an infection arises, but not otherwise, that's just like, you know, that there's some form of causation happening, right? So there is a linear timeline where causes and effects exist. Second, and relatedly, science progresses by improved instrumentation, by better record keeping. Star charts enabled celestial navigation. Johann Balmer's documentation of the exact spacing of hydrogen's emission spectra led to quantum mechanics. Gregor Mendel's careful counting of pea plants led to modern genetics. Things we counted as simply beyond human ken, the stars, the atom, the genome, became things humans can comprehend by simply counting.
Yeah.
So this one, I think, makes sense as well. It's just... math, right? Or like looking at data. And especially what's actually kind of interesting about these is, you know, it applies whether it's on a massive scale or a very small scale. But applying physics, applying science, applying counting to history helps us come up with other progress.
It's funny because for me, I thought of it from another angle, which was that if it's about instrumentation, or I like the idea of record keeping. For me, a big leap when I think about human history is the idea that a country like the UK, or at the time, I guess, Great Britain, was able to, there's this question, you know, like how did they do it? How do they manage an empire from London, right? Mm-hmm. That spanned the entire world at a time where there was none of this, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And so imagine the instruments. I mean, the leaps in progress and structure that they had to put together so that suddenly they have a functioning stock market, just like we said. I mean, the rise of the tulip market in the Netherlands is a precursor to what would happen in the city of London, which is, still exists today, which is the exchange of brokering information, basically, at tea houses, hence the job of brokering equity. And for what are the things that you need in place for that, right? You need like good bookkeeping, good tracking of navigation of the ships, an understanding of time and like time at a scale which is global, and that you can take actions on that and understand that over there you'll be able to get a response from. Crazy, right? So that really is the foundation for, I think, the way that we work today still in terms of how telecommunications allows, you know, our financial system to work.
Yeah.
And I think it was leaps and bounds of understanding, well, look at the connectivity. Once you have people playing on the same system and understanding this is the timekeeping that we're using, and this is the navigational rules we're keeping, because, you know, they're effective, they're efficient, but they're also something we can all agree on. Whoa, like what a leap and bound, you know, in terms of progress. And I don't have more on that. It's something that I want to look into, but it's exciting, you know, seeing that mentioned early on in this book, and what, I guess, whatever macro history means for the network state, the idea that we should be aware of this instrumentation, that we want to look at things closer and hopefully apply it to as many spaces as possible is really interesting.
Yeah,
my two cents.
I mean, 100%, right? Like, and we've seen so many different examples of this in science where, you know, focusing on space exploration has led to innovations in the commercial sector for, you know, individual consumers, or even in like military defense budgets has led to other things that are also for military. It's basically just, you know, why does record keeping and the scientific method lead to progress, right? Why is it important? And I think, you know, when we apply that concept, not just to the scientific method, but also to history, we'll find that we're going to come up with a lot more insights in the similar way that we talked about with microhistory, where Ray Dalio is looking at, you know, a zoomed out view of economic performance over the span of the entire world for all different countries and markets, and then can notice much more patterns that have happened before to real world problems today. And, you know, that provides a good compass, a good navigation system. So, truth, I will say, I don't want to say good things, but truth will come of better record keeping for the future. Okay, third.
I will say just on that point is, if anybody wants to look up the history of GMT and longitude and navigation, you should. I haven't that much, but every time I've dived into it, it's been amazing. So,
okay, cool.
Yeah, any nerds out there like me, please chase it up.
So third is, how do we even know anything about the history of ancient Rome or Egypt or medieval Europe? From artifacts and written records thousands of years ago, people were scratching customer reviews into a stone tablet. One of the first tablet-based apps, we know who Abelard and Eloise were from their letters to each other. Again, this is like linking out to something for Abelard and Eloise. We know what the Romans
Take
were like
out.
From what they recorded to a significant extent. What we know about history is what we've recovered from what people wrote down. So,
sure.
It's just an imperfect way of recording history, but it is still a way of recording history. And having that qualitative opinion history by analogy is still valuable.
Yeah. So at this point, I think we're starting to understand that he's putting together three, four different pieces that he's saying, okay, look, this is the progression of moments being recorded, observed, and valuable, basically. And from there, what you thought was sort of standalone examples of these cases are actually proving that there's an underlying, I don't know, how do you say, like, energy force within human history, which is to record, to analyze, to
right,
instrumentalize the information we have around us. And how do we know this? Well, here are all of these different examples in science, in history, in maths, and just even in the way that we approach our thinking today, when it comes to progress, which is really interesting. Again, it's once you look at this, what's the value system that you use to look at it? What's the lens? We've said this before in terms of the purpose of the network state will be really important in terms of defining how you instrumentalize this information in particular. But again, I guess if you, my point, what I appreciate is if we're putting it out there and we're saying this is something that's valuable and people are reading this when they're making their network state, then hopefully there's a better chance of, learning, I guess, from these kinds of things. Hoping, operative word. We got to talk to more network states to find out how much this plays.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely starting to make more and more sense as we're putting the pieces together of, how does all of these different ways of recording history come together, both in the ways that we have already done it and in the ways that it will now be possible, which brings us to this fourth point, right? So fourth, today we have digital documentation on an unprecedented scale. We have billions of people using social media each day for almost a decade now. We also have billions of phones taking daily photographs and videos. We have countless data feeds of instruments, and we have massive hard drives to store it all. So if reckoned on the basis of raw bytes, we likely record more information in a day than all of humanity recorded up to the year 1900. It is by far the most comprehensive log of human activity we've ever had. Right. So when you put all these four things together, you get that we can now see the continuum between macro history and micro history. We are collecting the kinds of precise quantitative micro historical measurements that typically led to the emergence of a new science, but at the scale of billions of people and going into our second decade. So, it's hard to extrapolate from here, but my initial take is if we see a history of the world, quote unquote, emerge from all of this data being logged, and I think this is what he goes into next when we talk about the Bitcoin blockchain, and it was recorded on a blockchain of sorts, and that was publicly available, you start to see how this could have a profound impact on the world as a whole. Because again, having this data that is immutable for everyone to look back at and see, and that is considered truth of what happened, right? It's not in a biased way. It's just like, well, these metrics were logged. And of course, everyone still has to think about, okay, well, how are they logged and who logged them and what were their
Why did they log
et
it
cetera.
also?
Yeah, why did they log it, right? But it was logged, that happened, and we can all see that. That's still a step up from where we are today.
No, that's a very good point on the blockchain side. I will say I've been having this thought, or I guess this conversation, since very early this morning, actually. Internally, but then also with some of with other people. At a nice coffee break, as one does. There's this, I was just thinking, like, there, maybe especially for our generation, because we live within the data, like we are the ones capturing and being captured by all of this. I think there is a kind of anxiety that comes with, everything being tracked,
Yeah,
which is,
monitored. It's very Big Brother vibes.
Very, and I'm not even alluding to that, but even today, people feel a certain amount of distrust towards governments, towards companies that track a lot of information, because they do not feel like they are truly in control. And, I don't think it's, I'm wondering at the moment, is I don't think it's a question of transparency or do I own that data, but why are you collecting that data in the first place? Like, leave me alone, What weirdo is getting excited about tracking all of this stuff? And I think it's try what I'm trying to do there is shift from like looking at these big data companies and governments as kind of evil or scary to being like, well, I think actually they might be quite silly because To be honest, Google is not a perfect, platform. Facebook has a terrible interface today and is quasi useless for our generation. Speaking personally, I don't know. But so, okay, great that they're collecting all this new data, which they sort of created within their own ecosystem. But are they really doing interesting things that are helping people with it? No, not really. So the bar for the network state to justify wanting to have access to all that information and acting like a positive actor, I think, is really high, because you really have to shake that foundation of like, oh, well, collecting data is evil to begin with, or it gives me anxiety. So it's like, okay, so to what purpose are we doing this? Because I think otherwise you might want to argue we don't want any of this at some point. How can we be trusted? And I don't know if the transparency argument is a good one, strong enough, basically, for some people.
I completely agree. And so, like, I'm going to read the next passages here because it's super relevant. So he says, on another term for big data should be big history. All data is a record of past events, sometimes the immediate past, sometimes the past of months or years ago. Sometimes, in the case of Google Books or the Digital Michelangelo Project, the past of decades or centuries ago. After all, what's another word for data storage in a computer? Memory. Memory as in the sense of human memory and as in the sense of history. That memory is commercially valuable. A technologist who neglects history ensures their users will get exploited. Proof? Question mark. Consider reputation systems. Any scaled marketplace has them. The history of an Uber driver or riders on platform behavior partially predicts their future behavior. Without years of star ratings, without memories of past actions of millions of people, these platforms would be wrecked by fraud. Macro history makes money. This is just one example. There are huge short and long-term incentives to record all this data, all this micro history and macro history, and future historians will study our digital log to understand what we were like as a civilization. So this is really where we get to the crux of what macro history is and why it's so important, before moving into the Bitcoin stuff, which we'll cover in the next episode. But it's back to what you were saying, right? Why do you want to measure this stuff? And it becomes a very slippery slope between this is great for market performance in terms of I'm a startup and I want to log feedback so that I can optimize my performance in whatever, whether it's, the quality of my Uber drivers or the quality of my service. But at the same time, if we're starting to monitor, what all these people are doing, where does the line get drawn on privacy? And so now it becomes that that conversation again. So I think,
blockchain is really interesting for that. Just because you could opt in to give different kinds of information, and then from that, be assigned different rewards, but also responsibilities, actually. And then by opting in, you also take on that responsibility, hopefully collectively ensuring that there is a responsibilization in the French sense. Responsibilization of what's going on, within that whatever data loop that you're trying to collect.
It's if it's opt-in, that's fine. And actually, I would take that a step further. But before I do,
please do.
Just to finish on the logging and stuff, right? And the how that creates a line. If we have this, and it's being done regularly. And by this, I mean macro history, and it's being logged regularly. It will still be very powerful for holding much more powerful entities accountable than what we currently have. And there is a possibility for that to happen without it infringing on privacy, right? And so I think that that's what he's getting at here, because we are talking about network states. We are talking about how this could be applied to governments and holding them accountable as well, right? Mm. But it's also relevant for startup societies and other companies of today where, if a company like, I'm just going to pick on the oil companies for a second, let's say like BP or whatever, had a massive oil spill.
Sponsored by BP, by the way. That's our
upcoming. Thanks, guys. In reality, we need sponsors, so let us know if you have any.
Throw some of that
But
oil money on us.
yeah, we love oil, guys. Absolutely love it. No, so
For breakfast.
just maintaining some log of, what were the damages that were done by these companies and where is it logged? So just in terms of like, okay, how much volume of oil was spilt in this region, right? Even just that is a quantified measure of that. And so, the gravity of the spill can then be measured against other companies like that, right? Or, against like more green energy companies that have zero spill, right? Or zero carbon emissions. And carbon emissions are a good example because like most things that we do emit them. So, yeah, I think it's just like, it's a great way to hold people accountable in a way that is more backed by truth than simple analogy where one person has a bad experience and then they call you out online and then you have, cancel culture and you're completely,
I knew it
eradicated
was
off
gonna
the
go
face
there.
of
I knew it
all.
was gonna go
But
there.
that's ultimately what this is about, right? It is about holding people accountable in the end. And so I much rather a world in which we are held accountable in a way where there's a unified blockchain of data that we can more
Could use some
agree
blockchain.
on, than we currently have, right? Rather than like a bunch of different stories, than what's happening today.
Yeah, totally agree. I think we're already seeing those examples pop up in blockchain. These are the cases you've mentioned are our use cases for blockchain technology for startups out there. We've been speaking to. Would be interesting to maybe bring on some of them as guests, actually, particularly on the climate change and environmental impact aspect.
Totally.
And then, I mean, I like where you took it, man. I like what you're doing with the let's make it
Well,
I think.
there is also one more thing, which is, when these countries bring together, I just shared an article recently on citizens' assemblies, which is where citizens come together. Usually it's a meetup that's organized by a nonprofit or some government organization of sorts to discuss a particularly hot topic or controversial topic that's affecting the citizenry, right? And so the nonprofit either works together with the government or they themselves invite experts and some other like officials of sorts, and then bring a diverse demographic that represents that whole country's citizenry together to then discuss an issue. And that could be climate change, that could be abortion, that could be whatever that a lot of people have differing viewpoints on. And what was interesting about that is that has been used already effectively to influence government regulation. However, when I was reading about it, and it's explaining that there are these experts that are coming in and they're sharing their opinion, I thought, well, okay, here's the same problem again. We have the nonprofit organization or potentially these government officials, that depends who's picking, determining who is an expert, quote unquote, and that can then be an extension of their bias. And so what I would see happening is, well, okay, you're bringing on an expert from a more CNN perspective, and I want to see an expert from more of a Fox perspective, or you're bringing one from a more liberal perspective. I want to see one from a more conservative perspective, right? And so we have to have the diverse representation in the experts as well. And if we do that, where is the truth, right? And that's where this comes in. Because if we have this shared blockchain of that citizen tree's data points, and this is all data that's captured around this issue, and it's just data, it's just like facts about what happens, right? So let's illustrate it with an example. Let's say it's abortion. This is obviously a very controversial topic. And you've got pro-lifers, you've got pro-choicers at this meeting, you've got people in the medical field at the Citizens Assembly who are experts on abortion, and they're sharing data and facts. And we can see this, right, on a blockchain. So it's like shared to everybody there. This is how many people get abortions. This is how many people get abortions because of things like rape or incest. This is how many people are against abortion in our country based on these surveys, right? These are like all the facts, right? And then you have the medical experts explaining, and this is something that was actually talked about in one of the UN's guidebooks on democracy, but like where doctors give patients all of the facts and multiple different doctors, right? So you hear from the anesthesiologist, you hear from the surgeon, you hear from your primary care provider about the risks of a certain surgery before they take your opinion about what to do seriously. So they don't let you decide until they know and they feel comfortable that you've understood the facts. And so, you know, that's also a slippery slope. But if we don't trust, you know, the doctor who's going to be performing surgery on us, I mean, that's like a whole other can of worms I don't want to open. So let's just stick with, you know, there is data. It's just factual data. Ideally, it's diverse data. So it's represented from all different sides, all different experts. And then you make a decision, right? That is a much more effective way to come to consensus than I saw this online on Facebook and, you know, everything's a conspiracy, or I only believe in what the experts that I follow have to say, and so everything you say doesn't matter, right? And that's just where, like, no one has a shared version of the truth, so you're not going to get anywhere. But having all of these diverse viewpoints with data and facts and experts from both sides or from all sides, which I prefer because I hate when it's always a binary, sharing their opinions will lead to better results than the current system.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand correctly, what you're saying is if we created a space or a moment in time where people could be exposed to the same and hopefully comprehensive information, then it would result in well-informed people who would then feed back into the system, I guess, points of view, opinions, desires, whatever, that would hopefully improve decision-making.
Yeah. And also, what's really interesting about this is politicians don't want to take a stance on these controversial issues because they don't want to alienate voters. And so what they tend to do is just like not share their opinion.
To lose money from
doing or lose money, right? Both, right? Yeah. I mean, it's one and the same, right? It's just like giving away power, giving away influence. And so what's really interesting is these citizens' assemblies doing that for them is actually kind of like a little test where they can see, oh, this is how a diverse set of my public or my citizenry would react to this. And this is the consensus they came to, and here's why. And then they're more likely to take a stance. And that's really important because if our politicians are more willing to take a stand on topics, and yes, some are obviously, and some do it on purpose, right? But they do it because they want to specifically appeal to this particular group. Instead of, I want to take a stance because I've looked at how our citizenry has reacted to this particular topic. I've listened to experts on both sides. I've seen the data on both sides or on all sides. And this was the most logical conclusion that I came to. And that's where I was going to bring this when we first, before we took this tangent, which is, why is tracking all this data so important? Okay, so when we have government officials who want to take data for the census, right? What they're trying to do is just get a picture of reality. What does the actual data say about where our citizenry is and what they think about and what their demographics are and what their psychographics are and whatever, right? And yes, most people are like, I don't want to do that. Like, I don't want to spend time like filling out this form, whatever. But on the whole, if more people did that, it would give more power. I don't want to say like necessarily a good thing, but it would give more power and insight to the government or the governing body to make decisions, because more data, right, generally leads to a better decision. And that's just like what gets measured gets managed. And so you could then say, okay, well, you know, half of our citizenry isn't happy, right? We're measuring on, you know, the cutting edge metrics of happiness, and they're expressing that they're not very happy. So let's start putting in some more programs or some more funding or some more whatever into increasing happiness. But if you don't know in the first place that happiness is at a deficit, why are you going to invest? Why are you going to pour any of your attention into it, right? And so having these kind of metrics about the social issues and the economic issues that we care about as a country, and it's accurate data and it's immutable data and it's representative, diverse data, means that the people in power, it's all kinds of data. but it means that these people in power, the people who are supposed to be representing our interests, don't really have an excuse to not look at that, right? Because it's all being tracked, it's all being shared, everybody else can see it. And so then it's just like, okay, well, if you're not looking at that data and making decisions based on that, you're just not doing your job. So why are you being elected as an official, right? And then that could also help keep those people accountable for, well, if you're not doing the things that the data is saying, and that we've all contributed to, or that all these nonprofits from around the country have, you know, spent the time and money to get a diverse sample of all the different people who can talk about a particular topic that's controversial. Why do we need you, right? Like, let's just have the citizen assemblies and have them represented directly to the top, right?
Direct democracy.
Right. And then it goes more towards self-governance. And I'm not saying that that's a better system at all. I'm just saying, if you want to be a politician and have the power to influence your local government, your responsibility is to do what's necessary to get the feedback, to get that data from the people that you're supposed to serve, and execute well on implementing the solutions that solve the problems that the data shows.
Wow. Adrian, did you just make that up on the spot?
Yeah, dude.
What? You didn't have that written out prepared for us or something?
No, but it's the same thing as what startups do, right? It's what's the same thing that founders do. It's like my job as the founder and CEO. Yeah, it's like I need to see the KPIs of how my startup is performing in order to come up with the solutions to solve those problems. If I don't have that data, how am I supposed to make, you know, the correct solution? How am I supposed to come up with that? And then not only that, but actually implement an effective solution and be held accountable for it if I don't have the data to show, did the solution that I implement actually change anything for the better?
I've never seen you this passionate about something.
But it's true, you know? Yeah.
No, it's beautiful. I mean, I think it's one of those things where, and I think this comes up with all this network state stuff, which is like beautiful in theory. All right, how do you put that into practice? And I mean, lots of things, cases that you brought that we can try and pick apart. But a really big question for me that stands out is how I hear about citizen assemblies, grassroots movements. I mean, there are a lot of the in my international environmental law masters, one of the things we analyzed were these conventions which had like entire sections asking for when there is an negative environmental impact, or even when there is just an environmental impact assessment to be done. So hopefully there is regulation that asks for this kind of thing to be done. One of the first things you're supposed to do is connect with the local population and ask them how they feel, what they think the baseline is. Create a baseline. That way, if something happens, you can, you know, you knew what the risks were. And we already know, like, okay, people said this is their level of standard. And with this activity, it actually degraded, you know, 15%, but that was actually 5% less than what we were expecting, you know, to be degraded. So they are owed this much compensation, for example. The thing, very hard to put in place, and also because very hard to get companies and governments to assume liability. I think we just saw that with a chemical runoff in Poland, where it killed like an entire ecosystem, fish washing up dead because of runoff, and they were like, "Well, this is because of toxic bacteria," and it's like, okay, but where does the toxic bacteria come from?
Exactly. Like, well, this is actually a thing that that we have nothing to do with.
whatever
You
that
know,
means. But
like
then okay, so let's assume that you are doing the work, and you're doing this in a way where you're somehow, you, the person in power or representing interests or making decisions, is acting, wholeheartedly. How do you incentivize people to participate? Like, why am I joining? Why do I care that I'm joining your abortion workshop? Part of my life is to be left alone. Like, as much as I care about like the legislation representing my opinions, I also don't want it to cost me my time. Your job is to figure this out. If you
Right.
and my time
Interesting.
is to, make money, take care of my family, like
Right.
do the things that I want to do.
I think this goes back to stuff we've talked about in previous episodes, which is, on the more micro scale, and this was actually with the interview that we did with Severin Deutschmann. If you haven't listened to it, check it out. Is,
It's
you
pretty
know,
dope. Even if
is
I wasn't on it.
on the more micro scale that you're looking at, the more relevant the issues become to you, right? So you may not be interested, and I'm just saying this as an example, in the toxic fallout of agriculture or whatever, like polluting some river and some local ocean life. Okay, but there are some issues that you do care about because they directly impact your life. And so, like, as much as you want to be left alone to make money to take care of your family, if it's an issue where it impedes your ability to be left alone and take care of your family, you're going to care, right? And so that's the kind of issues that these nonprofits and these other organizations are responsible to, convene that or empower the individual for you to convene it. And, like, it's not like these
But that's
nonprofits are a
where,
special entity. Anybody
yeah,
can
but
do this.
that's where, see, the problem with that system is, okay, well, what's being captured there is either local or short term. Like, we're only reacting. It's harder to be proactive in that system, and it's also much harder to be global in that system. And
I agree.
today, we need to be proactive about global situations.
Yeah.
So suddenly, grassroots bottom-ups approach. We want it, we talk about it, it's very valuable. It costs a lot of money to put in place. It takes a lot of time, energy, effort, willingness from people. Great to have that information. We might not have a an action out of that for 5 years, especially if the subject is like climate change. If it's e even things like abortion, where it's healthcare, and if healthcare is not well developed on a national scale, like it isn't in the US. At least for people's access to it and people's understanding of it, then suddenly it's going to be very difficult to steer. We see that also with gun regulations in the US. I think easy to say, let's incentivize people in issues that they care about. When do we get to the point where, oh, actually, there are experts out there who are warning us about things we should care about? We just haven't found the right way. Or, okay, they're not everything you're going to care about. Not everybody's responsibility is to care about everything,
Yeah.
also, but we need to deal with these issues.
This is
And how
this
does that
is
get done?
where I was gonna say, like, it comes down to a conversation about proactive versus reactive. And unfortunately, and I want to keep this tied to macro history, but it's all relevant because what do we do with this data, right? I actually think it solves the proactive versus reactive problem because, first of all, we as humans are biased to be reactive. We're not very good at being proactive. Our brains want us to, save as much energy as possible. And so we only really feel the motivation to act if it's urgent, or if there's some form of scarcity, or if it's like really painful generally, right? And so we want to get away from that feeling.
Probably why the
Sometimes,
concept of scarcity is actually such a prevalent one for economic things, because it motivates working
exactly.
and
Exactly.
productivity, I
And
guess.
it insinuates value, right? But so if you don't have those, and actually I would add, inspiration as well. And that's where the proactivity comes. But it's much harder to get inspired
Can you list them
to
again? What
act.
are the four?
So I would say
Inspiration,
like
scarcity.
inspiration, discomfort slash pain, scarcity, and urgency, right? So these are all like principles of influence that get us to act. And when we need to be proactive or reactive, it means that we need to act, right? Reactive, we're reacting to something that has happened, that motivates us. Proactive, we are thinking about what could happen, and that's motivating us to act, and planning ahead, right?
So we need
And
people to be able to think about what's happening, and you're leaving
exactly.
this with the data that's coming out.
Right. And so I think the tracking of the data, similarly to startups, the reason why that's also so important, and actually we can use the example of OpenAI, which recently has become very popular because of ChatGPT gaining enormous popularity. It's literally the most popular app ever. It grew to like over 100 million users faster than any other thing before. Now,
Because it's awesome.
why is this so important? Why is this so relevant? Okay. So when the company was made in the very beginning, it was co-founded by Elon Musk, Sam Altman, a bunch of other really smart people. And it was in response to the fear of AI getting out of hand and becoming way too powerful before we could see the problems that it would create and proactively solve those problems, right? So they were able to determine, if we don't create this organization and we don't stay at the forefront, the cutting edge of AI, and be transparent and have all of these regulatory processes to make sure that we're doing it ethically and we're doing it right and we're thinking about the potential consequences and the unintended consequences of what we're doing, this could be extremely dangerous. This could be an existential threat. And so that's a great example of humans thinking ahead and being proactive about a potential problem, right? Now, the reason I think that that one worked really well is because, well, they had like really smart people who came together to lead it, for one. But two, they really thought about looking at previous data and science fiction, actually, what could happen here? What could go wrong? And if that's the case, what's the best way for us to beat this? And the threat was real and big enough and relatable enough to most people that it made sense to be concerned about this, right? And this is also generally something that Adam Grant talks about in his work, where, like what motivates people to action from a decision-making perspective, especially for corporations, says number one, there needs to be an emotional shock, some form of emotional buy-in where the people who are the decision makers actually feel the problem, right? So one of the examples that he shared was, I don't remember what the company was, but they were wasting a bunch of money. It was one of these like contracting or construction companies. They were wasting a bunch of money buying individual gloves, like gloves for their workers. And those gloves were just not being used effectively, or they were expensive because they weren't standardized. And so what somebody did to solve this problem is they literally brought like all these gloves that were wasted to the board meeting and just like laid them out all on the table. And so that everybody could see, like, this is all of the money that we're wasting. All of this material right here, it's gone. Like, we're not using it effectively. We've spent all this time doing all this for nothing, right? So that's just an example. I don't think it's a great one, but it's an example of producing that emotional shock for those decision makers, right? Number two is, you want to appeal to the decision maker's values and sense of self or identity, right? And that's because if we believe the same things, we have the same values, we want to act in accordance with our values. Like, one of the most important denominating factors of our identity, or like what keeps us consistent, is that we want to believe that we are consistent with our sense of identity. So we will rarely act differently than what we believe we are, because it's not consistent. And that works both ways. So for example, if you wanted to lose weight, right? Say you were overweight, you wanted to lose some weight. Until your sense of identity changes to be, I am somebody who eats well or cares
atomic
about
habits.
Exercise. Right. Exactly. It's exactly what is talked about in Atomic Habits. It's
great book. James Clear sponsored the Network State podcast. Easy toss up that one. I'll take that one.
Well, easily take that one. Long story short, we need to appeal to people's sense of identity. And so the other example that Adam Grant shared was Texas had a massive littering problem. So people were just, tossing their trash outside of the outside of their cars, and it was like all over the freeways, and it was getting to a point where trash was becoming a real issue. And so they started a campaign, a video campaign that was shared by fellow Texans that were famous or celebrities or well-respected in the community. And I'm definitely butchering this, but they were basically sharing like, if I care about Texas, why would I litter on it, right? Like, why would I throw my trash in this place that I care about? Something along those lines. And it worked really well, right? So it was like, we're both Texans. We both care about this place. We don't want to disrespect this place because we both care about it. And therefore, we shouldn't litter, right? Mm. And so that's appealing to the sense of identity. And then the third step is to have an ask that's very, very small, right? And this goes same with behavioral psychology. BJ Fogg has a TED talk on this called Tiny Habits, where when you want to have a behavioral change, forget about big change, start with very small change. So he uses the example of flossing, right? If you want people to floss every day, instead of asking, floss all of your teeth, commit to just flossing one tooth. That's it. Okay. And what you find is the ask is so small, people feel more inclined to say yes and commit to it. And when they actually start flossing one tooth, then they just floss the rest of their teeth because they're already doing it. And it doesn't make sense to just floss one tooth, right? So just lowering that barrier to entry and making it super easy for people to commit makes a huge difference. Okay. So to tie all of this together, right? We've got multiple different factors that we need to consider for people to make this kind of behavioral change. And when we bring all of these behavioral change factors together with the fact that we have a consensus or a better consensus of what the problems are and ideally what the solutions are to those problems, then it's just a question of, okay, who's going to execute this? And that's where we bring in, is it going to be the politician, right? Is it going to be the mayor? Is it going to be the citizens themselves? But at least we have a plan. We know that the plan was come to together. And we know that there are ways that are effectively proven psychologically to get change to happen or to get behavior change to happen.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I think we should just pitch it. We should just pitch it to someone. Find a network state, see if they're into it.
I mean, if I were to start a network state, which I'm sure we will at some point.
The network state podcast state.
Yes, the network state podcast network state. We're just going to just like go in a full loop.
There's a podcast about the network state podcast state. It's called the network state podcast state podcast.
It's the network state podcast network state podcast. But yeah, so those are the kinds of principles that I would want to influence. And then one more thing that I will add to that is there's a very famous psychiatrist and clinical psychologist named Dr. Ross Green, who started a model called the CPS model, the Collaborative and Proactive Solutions Model. And the reason that this model works, this is generally actually used for families coping with ADHD, where the parents and the kids should be using this model to come up with solutions to solve their problems, right? And the reason this works in that setting is because the parents and the kids obviously have very different opinions about how to solve the problems that they're experiencing. But the principles of that model apply in this case. And it's because when you come up with solutions collaboratively and proactively, people feel ownership in having come up with a solution. And back to why that ownership is important, if you are giving a sense of your effort or identity or attention to a certain thing, you feel more bought into it. And if you feel more bought into it, you're more likely to stick to it. You're more likely to implement it or execute it. And so these citizens assemblies are essentially doing that. They're applying the CPS model to governance, to democracy in these micro scales. And if we add in that data side of it with these macro history recorded blockchain type measurements, I think that that will lead to more effective solutions, right? Better answers to problems that are more holistically solved because they're getting it from many diverse perspectives. And then most importantly, more adherence and better execution of the solutions. And so we should see much more measurable improvements in that data. And then it's just cool, like iterate. We implemented this solution. These were the results that we've measured, right? And we can see the impact of that solution. And if it didn't work, then we need to try something else. If it did work, why did it work? Let's try to replicate that and then see if we can improve it even further.
Yeah. Again, there, I think the crucial point is how do you incentivize the different stakeholders to even gather around and pay attention to this thing? And depending on the issue there, I see what you've described as something that we use in my background in change management, which is the co-design methodology, which is sort of self-explanatory, but you're going to design a solution in a collaborative setting, usually guided through by a facilitator or a team of facilitators who are bringing different, who are offering actually different points of information, but actually really a methodology which enables people who have varying different motivations, desires, goals, whatever, to work around one issue and tackle that and solve that and usually come up with a strategy. Again, there you go, to execute on it. It's something that I think came out of the late 80s, maybe 80s. It's called pioneered by, it's called MG Taylor. So I think it's Matt and Gail Taylor. They made it for, design thinking methodology. They used it first, I think it was for Accenture, and now they have their own consultancy. And that's how they actually handle some pretty amazing like UN or national like issues. I think there was a question about how do we reframe. They were the ones organizing is too light of a word, but basically like facilitating the cultural re-envisioning of New Zealand so that it would better represent its colonial and then also like pre-colonial and native groups, I guess, heritage, everything, and how to make that a part of its national identity going forward. So they went out of their way, and I think they brought in something like 300 stakeholders. We're talking, this is huge, right? Like 300 stakeholders, including probably like the prime minister, at least the prime minister's office. We're talking about representatives from different tribes, really culturally like diverse points of views with coming from different alignment points from society. I'm sure it took at least six months to get that ready. Then it's a conference that happened over 3 days, or a workshop, if you will. And then the results are like, you know, directly probably a couple of years, but realistically a 5-year impact. So a lot of effort, a lot of work, incentive there, I think partly because, you know, there was a wrong that needed to be righted.
Yeah.
And New Zealand is maybe one of those kinds of countries, places where they're able to take these kinds of alternative initiatives. And it actually makes sense because it's not that big of a country. Trying to do that on an American scale, what does that look like, you know?
Yeah,
how do you make that cost effective for the decisions? Interesting.
First of all, commendable, right? Like the fact that they even did it. And it's interesting when you were saying that.
This doesn't catch the headlines, by the way, but this is the work that I've, like, my colleagues were on this project brought in as facilitators because they have that expertise. But that, for me, that was, I mean, I'm bringing it up because I think it's headline work.
Totally. And this is the the point I was going to make as well, right? Like, it seems like there are many different organizations, many different individuals who've studied this or made it their life's work to study this, came to the same conclusion, right? It's some version of a CPS model with diverse viewpoints, with thoughtful disagreement, right? Like Ray Dalio at Bridgewater talks about this too. There's a consensus around how do we make good decisions, right? How do we have a forum that leads to good decisions? And yes, that's the kind of stuff that we should be talking about a lot more, that should be in the news. Like, here are ways that we can solve all these problems that we're having. But, you know, without going on that tangent, that's not as sexy. That's not as controversial. That's not getting the clicks and the eyeballs. And so it's not making headlines. But what leads to us having a more optimistic perspective, and what leads to us actually solving these problems, is sharing solutions that have proven to work in the past, and that we can build on and iterate and make better. So we hope you, the community listening to this, help spread that message, right? We want to hear from you. We want to hear about, like, what do you think would be a good way of coming to thoughtful disagreements that lead to the best solutions, and what ways we can organize ourselves to get this perspective out there in a sea of negativity and controversy.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to stop. I feel like next episode is going to hopefully open up something very exciting. I mean, Bitcoin is trending again right now, which is kind of fun. So,
yeah, I mean, this is, I think we're going to get into the more technical sides of how this macro history could be recorded. So,
but because stay tuned. We don't understand the technical side, we're going to go on these tangents anyway.
Yeah. Hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, please like, comment, subscribe, share. It really helps us.
Come find us.
Grab a cup of coffee,
you know.
Yeah. Twitter, LinkedIn.
This is my last name. You can find me.
Yeah. Join the newsletter. That's also the best way to reach us. And we'll see you in the next one.